Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do.
That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill building courses for you to choose from because the steps that you choose to take today will help you to love what you do in the future. And that's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking using debt to build wealth with Tom Anderson.
Right, so virtually all conventional wisdom out there points folks in the direction of paying off their debt, right? Like, debt is dumb. That's the line that you'll hear after listening to most personal finance podcasts for no more than 30 seconds. It's the mantra. It's the driving force behind many money experts out there. But our guest today wants folks to take another look. He wants them to reconsider debt. And Tom Anderson, he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Value of Debt. And he's actually written multiple books on using debt in order to build wealth. But while most financial planning experts are only looking to grow assets and to decrease liabilities, Tom advocates for the strategic use of debt. And that's what we're talking about today. So, Tom, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Joel and Matt. I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad to have you, Tom. And the first question we ask everybody who comes on the show, we want to know kind of what they like to splurge on while they're saving and investing and thinking about their future. What is it that you like to splurge on? We call it the craft beer equivalent because Matt and I, we like craft beer quite a bit. What are you
literally drinking one right now?
Yeah. So what's your craft beer equivalent, Tom?
Wow. I like that craft beer plan. That's a good one. I would say that my splurge is a couple of years ago, I started getting into sailing. And so anytime you do that, it can be a very expensive and nice splurge. I try to keep it under control by just doing it as a share. So I'd have a boat share that we enjoy with our family a whole bunch.
Oh, nice. So are you paying for access or do you have an actual boat that you have some sort of equity built up into? How does that work?
Oh, it's actually a really neat program. We should do a separate show on it, but I'll just give you the quick overview. So you do, there's eight families share it. And what you have is that the months in Chicago is where I live. So you have May, June, July, August, and September. And each day has two spots. And you have this auction every year, basically, and you allocate the shares. So you get to go out about 30 times, but you basically only have about an eighth of the expense. So it works.
Nice.
It's a little bit more than that. But yeah, you don't have to worry about the maintenance. And it's a great program, and you don't have to worry about all the pain and the things about owning a boat. So yeah,
and that sounds better than owning a boat completely on your own, and everything, all the headaches that come with that are all on you. But when you share it, you get to distribute that mess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and even like we've got a friend out in California, and I mean, when they were living out there, they were part of like a boating club or something like that, and they were spending a decent amount of money, but I still got to think that joining one of those clubs is still a more affordable way to go out on the water rather than actually purchasing a boat and then having to what is it? You pay for a slip? Is that the right term? I don't know.
I think so.
But there are all those expenses associated with it. But that's really cool. I guess with you being in Chicago there, it makes a lot of sense to get out on that lake.
Yeah, it's a short season. And the nice thing is, I mean, the average user only uses 70% of their spots. So, I mean, it's a lot to get out there 20 times and you get 30 spots. And the remaining open spots you can end up using and they kind of go into a lottery system. So, yeah, it's great. I can't imagine who'd get out more than that.
Nice. All right. Well, let's shift gears and instead of talking about boating, let's talk about debts.
I like it.
Generally, yeah, you talk about just how it gets a bad rap. It seems like anti-debt hysteria. It seems like it's running rampant. And on its face, it kind of sounds like an odd take. But why is debt so often misunderstood?
I think debt is so often misunderstood because a lot of people have a bad experience with it, and there's a lot of bad debt that's out there. So first of all, it is absolutely not my view that all debt is good debt. Essentially, I think there's some debt that's good debt and some debt that's bad debt, and debt that's good debt should be evaluated thoughtfully, and debt that's bad debt should be eliminated. It's really about that simple.
Yeah, so this is going to be a nuanced conversation here, which I'm glad. I think what Matt alluded to in the intro when he said that a lot of people say debt is dumb, that is not nuanced, right? That is one particular take that tries to say that debt is a nail and it should be pounded, you know, anytime. Like it's really just like a one size fits all kind of way of viewing the world. But you're also, you're not talking about taking on debt to spend lavishly, to go out there and buy ridiculous things that you can't actually afford. You're talking about taking calculated risks, right?
Very much so. This is absolutely not about buying things that you can't afford. So this is just about making strategic decisions with when you should be using low-cost debt and when you should be choosing to pay down that debt versus when you should be choosing to emphasize things like liquidity and flexibility and just building up your savings.
And we're going to get to all of that. But so as a quick example, like skipping retirement contributions, oftentimes we're faced with a question here on the show where folks are like, do I pause my retirement investing in order to pay down debt? Do I take money out of my retirement accounts in order to pay down this debt? That's often a question that folks are wrestling with.
We literally had a listener recently, Tom, who said, hey, I've got a 16% debt, but should I take my contributions out of my Roth IRA to pay it off? These are the kind of questions that we're getting regularly.
Yeah, it's one of those options, but you often will say that folks are being short-sighted if they skip out on those retirement contributions in order to pay down some of that debt. How might that actually end up happening?
Yeah, so let's lean into what that listener had asked and kind of think about that question just a little bit. So first of all, let's say that, let's just go to the extreme because I think we can set the table with an example that we would all agree. Let's say that you were in the fortunate position that you got a mortgage when rates were really low and your mortgage is at, let's say, 3%. And let's just say that it's tax deductible. And today there are bank accounts that in your checking account you can earn, you know, about 3 to 4%. So if my after-tax mortgage is about 2%, I think in this environment, we would say, hey, I don't know that I want to rush to pay down that type of debt. Does that kind of simple example start by making sense of maybe that would be a form of debt that we wouldn't want to rush to pay down?
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so basically, I mean, and you're talking about capturing the spread here, right?
Yes.
And so is there some sort of threshold in your mind, is there a minimum sort of spread that you would want folks to see before they are considering something like that? Or is it more on an individual basis that you want folks to consider that?
This is absolutely about capturing the spread. And this is exactly where the conversation is fun to have. So first of all, if we can start by saying, hey, some debt might be good debt, and I should be thoughtful about paying that down. And an example of that would be if I had a mortgage at 2% or a student loan at 3%. That's already then people are being thoughtful and saying, well, hey, maybe that might be a good form of debt. Let's just jump to the other end and then we'll come in the middle, which is where your question is. If I have a credit card debt running at 25 or 30%, if you pay that down, you get a guaranteed return of 25 or 30%. So nothing delivers that type of return. So obviously things like credit card debt or anything over 20%, we can very quickly agree is bad. So if we just set these field goals here, essentially of like, let's say 2% is good and 20% is bad, we now can talk about the middle. So then I think from there, the preference is to be toward the lower end, it's more likely to be good, and toward the higher end, it's more likely to be bad. So You can look at this in absolute rates, or you can look at it in relative. So I like to think about it like any debt that's over 10%, if we kind of call that the midpoint, is going to be more toward the bad category. So that's going to be most forms of consumer debt. But any debt that's going to be kind of under the 7% range, I think it's going to be more toward the potentially good category. So that might be things like mortgages. It might be things like student debt. And between 7 and 10 really depends and is a little bit more personal, but I think it can require a little bit more analysis, and it's a fun area to talk about.
Yeah, and one of the things you just talked about kind of with mortgages, it's not just the interest rate that you're paying, but there's also potential tax benefits that you get from holding onto that mortgage. And I think you've said that it's a mathematical fact that debt can increase returns and reduce taxes, which is a bold statement, but you're definitely right on the reducing taxes part. But is that a big part of the reason to consider holding onto debt as part of kind of your overall money strategy?
Yeah, and a lot of tax things have changed recently. And, you know, the original book came out 10 years ago, but there always are different tax benefits. And while that's a part of it, I think you can almost even set the tax part aside and call that like kind of gravy and say, look, if on average, if your investments can earn, you know, forget 10%, let's just say they earn 8%, and let's just say that your debt cost, you know, 6%, then you're capturing a spread of 2%, and that can add up to thousands and thousands of dollars a year. It can add up to hundreds of thousands of dollars over a lifetime.
Right. So let's take a very high level sort of view here. Like anytime you approach debt, like there obviously have to be some guardrails in place, right? And so you've talked before about your five tenets of a strategic debt philosophy. Can you kind of share what those tenets are and then kind of explain how it is that we could use those tenets to implement some debt in our life in order to build wealth more quickly?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that you really just want to be thoughtful about what applies to you. And so you want to start by taking a holistic view and looking at the big picture. So that's where it starts. So when you're thinking about these different pieces, you want to start with the big picture. What are the things that I'm trying to accomplish? So this is a part of like a broader philosophy. And so the first thing is that we want to be looking in a big picture sense. And I think that what that means is you want to be looking across kind of your complete financial plan. So the next part of this, the next tenet is to say, like, once you're looking at the big picture, to explore thinking and acting like a company. So when you think about it, companies have a CFO, and what a CFO does is they actually design the balance sheet of a company. They choose how much debt that should have and how it should be structured. So if you think about a company that you like or admire, like an Apple or a Google, they have debt, which they choose to have because of the liquidity, the flexibility, and the tax benefits associated with that debt. They could choose to not have it, but they actually choose to have it. We'll kind of explore that a little bit more, but it's an interesting thing where I think we can learn, not that we are companies, but we can learn from the ideas that they're doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to interject real quick, you said that we're not companies, but I should be thinking of myself as like the CFO of my own finances. And I like what you said as far as the debt that companies take on, it's an intentional decision, right? Like you said that they're designing that. And unfortunately, oftentimes in our lives, when we enter into debt, we're not doing it on purpose. It's something that we're sort of, we're being sold quite literally goods. And it's something that we're more or less falling into as opposed to like strategically
choosing on purpose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually lean into what you're talking about just a little bit. See, if I'm a company and I don't have the right debt ratio, then someone like a Carl Icahn gets crabby with me and they come in and they buy me and they lever me appropriately, right? So all companies have this like pressure by shareholders to kind of have the right type of a debt philosophy. But people tend to either have way too much debt or they're completely debt averse. And I think that there's this optimal middle ground where very few people actually happen to be, and those that are actually are there by luck more than a strategic choice. We just start out with way too much debt, and then we go to way too little, and I think there's this balanced ground that's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. You also, you talk about being open-minded and then verifying what works. And I think that being open-minded is probably really important because Matt and I, we sometimes find ourselves in this interesting place as personal finance podcasters where we talk about using debt strategically. And we talk about the differences of good debt and bad debt. And we'll get pushback sometimes from the anti-debt community. And they're like, no, all debt is bad. But the reality, especially when you're talking about the mortgage rates, that's the perfect example right now. There's a lot of our listeners who have locked in low mortgage rates of 2.5% to 3%, 3.5% maybe, right? And now when you can make more in a savings account, like it just, you have to be open-minded and be willing to change your trajectory a little bit based on kind of what's happening right now. But one of the things you talk about is the optimal debt ratio. And I think that's probably something worth kind of drilling down on a little bit. Because it's obviously, like you said, some people have way too much debt, some people have no debt at all. But yeah, talk to us about the optimal debt ratio and how we kind of figure out what that is in our lives.
Yeah, so the optimal debt ratio is how much you're borrowing against the assets that you have. And so if I am, you know, buying a TV on a credit card, then a year from now, my TV is worth less. And my credit card debt went from, you know, let's say it was a $2,000 TV. If I didn't make payments on it, that's, I owe $2,400 on a, what is worth a $1,500 TV. And then my debt ratio would be upside down because I own more than I owe. And so that would be an example of a bad debt ratio, right? And that makes sense. The other side of this is, let's say that you own something like a house, which, you know, certainly can go down in value, but maybe over a long period of time, like 10 or 20 years, might tend to go up in value a little bit over time. Then you want to think about, well, if this asset is going up in value over time, even if I keep my debt relatively the same, it's actually gradually falling. So if you even just make the base payments on your student loan or just make the base payment on your mortgage, but that house is going up, your debt ratio is actually drifting down. And so companies look at this a lot. And what I like to kind of explore is a debt ratio of around 30%. And so that's where people tend to have way more debt than that or way less debt than that. But it's a fun place to start the conversation.
I think maybe how it is we define debt, I think that can go a long ways in helping us to determine whether or not certain debts in our lives might be helpful, you know, how they might be able to help out our bottom line or not. We'll get to some of those different definitions and we'll kind of talk about liquidity as well. We'll get to all of that right after this.
Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's Cachava.com/howtomoney.
You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life? What are you doing now to help you to get there? Well, there are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP.
What about that dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events.
So it's safe to say it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, your health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking about using debt to build wealth. We're having this conversation with Tom Anderson. And Tom, you have different debt definitions, basically. And like I alluded to, Matt and I, we talk about the kind of good debt versus bad debt, strategic debt versus debt that's going to leave you kind of by the side of the road, you know, bleeding and hurt. But you're not talking about credit card debt as something that we should hold on to, but you have three different like working definitions. Can you define them? They're oppressive debt, working debt, and enriching debt. I'm curious to hear kind of, yeah, what those are for you.
Yeah. So oppressive debt is where I just want to make sure that everybody on this call is completely aligned and that all of your listeners know things like credit card debt, debt that costs, in my world, more than 10%, and clearly debt that costs more than 20% is oppressive debt. It is bad debt. And all of the conventional wisdom that you hear on debt is correct with respect to oppressive debt. It just puts you in a cycle that is difficult to break. If you're buying things that you can't afford, you never break through. And I think that a very solid 50% of America gets trapped by oppressive debt, perhaps benefits from conventional wisdom. And I just want to hit the table and scream, like, oppressive debt is terrible.
So working debt and enriching debt, what are those for us then?
So working debt is going to be things that we're talking about, like a mortgage. It's going to be lower cost, maybe a low cost car loan, which is not going to be a bad thing to buy a car rather than buying a car with cash. But there could be reasons to use a low cost car loan rather than paying for your school in cash. There can be a reason to have a school loan. Those are you're buying an asset that you're going to pay for over time or earn more money over time. That's going to have a lower rate associated with it, a rate that's typically, you know, in the low to mid single digits. Those can be examples of good debt that should be thought of much more carefully and can potentially add value to you in your life. That's working debt.
And then the last type of debt you mentioned is enriching debt.
Yeah, some people would say that's an oxymoron. So I'm curious to hear how you talk about that.
The interesting thing is that when you think about billionaires, what percentage of them do you think borrow money?
Most of them, all of them,
yeah, virtually all of them.
So that's interesting. Most of them and all of them. So we don't have great data, but it's approximately 70% of them is the best that can be discerned. But it with trends toward higher. So, but it is very clear that the vast majority do borrow money. So why, if you're a billionaire, would you choose to borrow money? Because of course you could choose to not have debt. So why are we seeing the affluent people in America, the 1% that could choose to not have debt, why do you think that they choose to have debt?
So they don't have to sell their assets and pay taxes on those gains.
That's absolutely one reason that they do it, is so they don't have to sell assets and so that they don't have to pay taxes on the gains. But sometimes if you see, like, you know, Elon Musk has many different businesses, but then he's sitting around and he's like, hey, I'd like to buy Twitter. So he wanted to fund that acquisition with debt by not selling his other assets. And so then he's constantly building up more assets. And you see this across the high net worth spectrum. Enriching debt is when you could choose to pay cash for something, or you could choose to sell an asset for something, but you are making a strategic choice to use debt as a tool to buy it instead. You see that all the time in the high net worth market and the ultra high net worth market, and it is a strategy that the rest of America 100% can learn from.
So why don't they? So my question is, obviously paying cash for everything, not taking on additional debt, like that is going to be a more straightforward and simple path to take. Is that the main reason? Like, is that why it is that folks tend to think, all right, I'm just going to focus on paying off my mortgage. I'm just going to focus on completely eliminating all forms of debt that I have, as opposed to looking at it a little more strategically? Is it because folks aren't thinking about it strategically?
Yes, it's because people aren't thinking about it strategically. And as you move up the net worth spectrum, you get more and more advisors. And those advisors tell you about the benefits of the strategies of using your balance sheet in a holistic way to kind of maximize your long-term net worth. You really, these high net worth people are like little companies, right? With lots of different advisors, and they're thinking about things strategically. And that's what I think that we can do as well, is that there are times when you could pay cash for something, but you instead, or you could pay down your debt, but you choose to make a different decision. And it's when you're making a different choice, you're choosing to invest rather than pay down debt. You're choosing to buy an asset, that you're making a strategic choice. And that's where I think we can learn.
Yeah. Makes me think of the one time that I bought a new car. I bought a Nissan Leaf, and I chose to get financing for the car because it was 0% for 5 years. And yep. So it was one of those things where normally I would, one, not buy a new car, or two, if I did, I would pay cash for it. And I had the money, I could have, but it just made sense when someone's saying 0% and it was something I was going to buy anyway, to make that choice and allow that debt to kind of free up my cash to do better things. But one of the things that you say too, you say that whether debt is good or bad, it depends on your resources relative to your needs. And basically, like, where people are at in their financial journey should influence how they think about and incorporate debt, right? So how should people think about, hey, I'm just getting started in my personal finance journey. How should I think about debt versus someone who's years and years into investing and saving and paying down the worst kinds of debt?
Yeah, so we're all at different points in the journey, and you've got a lot that kind of combines here. So let's use your example of the car for a second. Over time, of course, it's nice if you can capture the spread, and it would be great if you could earn, let's just say, 6% and your cost of your car loan was 4%, then, you know, that's nice. But early in your journey and thinking about your car, what I think is actually more interesting and more important is you said that you had the cash and you could have paid for it, but you were attracted to the 0%. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, well, I was planning on getting the car anyway. There were some tax, federal and mm-hmm. state tax incentives. And so it was like, okay, this is the time to pounce. The overall cost of that car is low. Normally, I wouldn't buy a new car. And then boom, cherry on top was the fact that I could get a 0% loan.
So I love the decision that you made there. I just think it was perfect. And one of the biggest reasons I think it was perfect is it left you with the money in the bank that you would have had in the car loan otherwise. You see, what happens is because you had that money in the bank, when you lose your job, you can't get the money back out of the car. It's so important that we have a cash reserve and that we have liquidity. And so when we're looking at these different phases, some people are so focused on paying off debt, any form of debt at any rate quickly. But once you pay it off, if I pay off my student loan, I can't get that money back. If I put down $100,000 on my house, I can't access that if I lose my job. I pay off my car. The only way I can get that money back is to sell my car. And that's why we get into this liquidity trap. And it's actually liquidity that creates crisis in people's lives.
Yeah. On that note, in a recent talk, you mentioned the intersection of a crisis that you were facing personally, the intersection of that with what the market was doing at that point in time. Can you share that story with our listeners?
Yeah. So at the time I was living in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and the sixth worst natural disaster in the history of the United States up to then was in Cedar Rapids. And the Cedar River just leapt out of its banks and just it was a huge amount of flood damage. And my office was destroyed, and it was in an area that wasn't supposed to even, you know, get wet. The county kept all the court records in the basement of the building and didn't even move them because this is a site that shouldn't get wet. And so, you know, when that happens, you need money right away. And natural disasters strike everywhere. I mean, you have hurricanes, floods, tornadoes. It's you never know, you know, what it's going to be. And insurance can certainly be helpful, and it was helpful for me. But insurance doesn't say, hey, you need a lot of money right now. I'll just send you a check and you send back the rest. Like, you need liquidity to get through, you know, that scenario, and you need it before the insurance is there. The timing of that, if you caught, was in 2008 and coming right into the financial crisis. And so if my solution would have been, well, I'm going to sell my assets at this point in time, that would have been devastating. I just needed to get through a terrible period that was already, you know, my life upside down and my business under fire. It just having access to money is what really matters. And that's what debt can be access to money. A line of credit can be access to money. Cash in the bank can be access to money. But people just don't emphasize enough having liquidity, and they instead prioritize paying down debt at all costs. And I don't understand it.
Yeah. So liquidity puts you in a position of power in a lot of ways, right? Where you can make different choices as opposed to having no cash in the bank or no access to funds, but maybe a slate of zero debt. But let's talk about maybe a few examples. For instance, if you own a home, having a HELOC, right? That's one way in which you could have potential liquidity. How else have you seen like middle income folks using debt intelligently? Like what are the methods? What are the paths they pursue for that?
Sure. Well, so one of the most simple things that I don't understand why a lot of people don't do, but it's having a credit card and not using it. There's a lot to that. I mean, that's just an interesting thing to pause on, right?
Yeah.
Or you using it and paying it off every month. So if you have a credit card and you can access, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 if there was an emergency, but the second that you start to carry a balance on a credit card, you now, if there's an emergency, you have two problems. You owe that huge interest rate on the balance due, you can't repay it, and you don't have access to as much credit. So there's so many bad things about carrying a credit card balance. That's just a huge place to start. Don't carry a credit card balance. You avoid oppressive debt, you have access to credit, and that's just, that's kind of base one. Number two would be a home equity line of credit. Rather than using the home equity line of credit for the home improvement project, imagine that you have access to the money that you could borrow in case you're in an emergency. This is what CFOs of companies do. All companies have access to lines of credit in bad times. That's the first job. If I'm president of a company and you're the CFO, I'd say, set up a line of credit. And if you didn't, I would fire you. So a home equity line of credit, a credit card, a personal line of credit, setting them up and not using them is a fabulous defensive strategy.
I mean, bottom line, there are massive amounts of folks who might go through those initial steps, but then they don't hit pause. They, in fact, use them. And I think that's the biggest problem here. Like, I think from a psychological standpoint, the biggest hurdle is for folks to have a table lined with a bunch of different pies that smell and look wonderful, but they're told, don't touch those desserts. It's having that cash available to them. And they're thinking, man, I would really love to be able to do something.
It takes discipline.
With some of those lines of credit, but I'm currently not in a situation that calls for that. I think that's the biggest difference between, you know, what it is that you're advocating here versus the more mainstream conventional wisdom of completely eliminating debt. There's that psychological side of things where folks, like you said, Joel, where folks don't have that discipline to say no.
And that is the fifth tenet, is what you have to, as we were talking before, you have to verify what works for you. But obviously, mathematically and logically, it's better for someone to have access to money than not have access to money. Mm-hmm. So my view is that you should have access to lines of credit, and that will be good for you because it protects you in a bad time. That is right out of the CFP book, the Certified Financial Planners. I mean, this is what you should do. But you are absolutely right. A lot of people can't handle having access to the credit because then they will spend it, but you're spending money that you don't have. So that is, of course, a terrible idea and not what we're talking about today.
Yeah. So obviously we're seeing, you mentioned savings accounts rates in the 3-4% range, which is nice to finally see. We had a bunch of years there where the best you could expect to earn would be 0.5%. And so I guess I'm curious, did like near zero rates on savings make you feel any differently? There was a whole contingent of people who would say cash is trash and put your money to work for you in the market, and liquidity became less of a concern. Or did you still feel the same way about liquidity even at a time when savings rates were pretty abysmal?
First of all, I'm always a fan of liquidity. And so from a liquidity perspective, you want to have access to lines of credit and you want to have a 3-6 month cash reserve. And those two things of conventional wisdom are absolutely completely right. So having some cash and having some debt, just kind of like back to that car example, is not necessarily bad. You don't always have to have a positive spread. If you had some debt that was costing you a little bit more than you were earning on your cash, that's not necessarily a bad thing because you benefit from the liquidity. So then when you look at interest rate environments in, 2013, when the book came out, let's just say that interest rates were at zero on cash and borrowing rates were sometimes zero on a car, but typically higher in a home. So, why if cash is at zero and my home loan is at 4%, your value of debt idea is a dumb idea? Well, of course, we can look at that now and say, look, over the past 10 years, anything that you owned has gone up a lot in value and cash rates are higher. Mm-hmm. And if you locked in those low rates, of course, that looks like that was a great, trade. A famous economist said that interest rates are neither good nor bad. They're a function of the environment at any point in time. So you don't want to be looking at your debt relative to just your cash. You want to be looking at it relative to everything that you own. And so, if stocks go up at inflation plus 3 to 4% over time, and you're borrowing at rates closer to inflation, then over time, these strategies add up to just a tremendous amount of value. So you have less stress and you're making more money when you're embracing these ideas.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So Tom, we've got a couple more questions to get to with you about debt, using debt to build wealth, including we want to talk about, what if you've already got debt on hand? How do you know whether that's a debt that needs to be eliminated or one that you should keep around? We'll discuss that right after this. Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney.
You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life? What are you doing now to help you to get there? Well, there are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP.
What about that dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events.
So it's safe to say it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, your health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, we are back and we are talking with Tom Anderson still about using debt in order to build wealth. And just before the break, you're talking about interest rates, how different rates, whether or not they're good or bad, isn't necessarily the case. Oftentimes, you have to look at your own personal situation. And along those lines, like, what about the psychological reality of debt, right? Because different folks have different preferences as to what it is that they prefer in their own lives. And there's a lot of folks out there who find it hard to sleep at night having debt hanging over their head. How do you talk to your clients when they get nervous about keeping some of those smart debts just around longer in their lives?
Yeah, so often what we tend to do in America is we take on a whole bunch of debt early in our life, and then we spend a long number of years racing to pay that debt down, and then we wake up when we're 50 and we feel like we're undersaved, and so then we try to save for 15 years and then we want to retire, and that mathematically just doesn't work. I mean, it works if you're going to save basically 25% or more of your income, but if you're not going to save at a very aggressive rate, that strategy is flawed. It is why a lot of people wake up and they feel behind, and it's why people don't feel on track. If you take on too much debt early at too high of a cost, and then you spend all your time paying that down, and then you wake up and try to save, the math doesn't work. So I don't think that you should sleep well with that strategy, because it's a mathematically flawed strategy. The alternate strategy is that you could build up assets early in your life. Invest. This is not about taking the money that would have gone to pay down debt and going to Disneyland or going boating like we were talking about in the beginning. It's about taking the money and saving it. And once you save it, you can either put it in cash, which builds up your liquidity, or you can build up your investments. But if you start saving and building up your investments early, you have more money growing for you for a longer period of time, and then you can pay down your debts later. So then what happens is, let's say I wake up, if I have $2 million of assets and $500,000 worth of debt, I'm a millionaire, right? I'm worth $1.5 million. That's better for me than having no debt and $500,000 of assets. And that's where just a lot of people find themselves, is they wake up with maybe I paid down my debt, but I don't have enough assets, and their dreams don't come together. My goal is to make these dreams happen.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Well, one, you said that mathematically it just doesn't work, right? To take that approach of not investing until you're just a decade and a half from retirement. But I also love what you said there too. Most people are thinking of debt as like that people are taking it on purposefully to buy things that they can't necessarily afford. But you're saying, no, that's not what debt should be used for. Debt should be used to allow you to funnel that money into more productive ways, right?
It should allow you to, by keeping that debt in place, the money you would have put toward the debt, you should save. And people are not saving enough money, and that is the problem. Yeah. And that is why we have all this stress. That money is the number one cause of stress. People don't have liquidity. Yeah. They don't have enough savings.
And that's why so many people are in the personal finance realm saying it's a one-size-fits-all approach and that debt should just be avoided like the plague, because they know that the reality for most Americans is that if they take on more debt, they're not going to use their extra cash to save or invest. They're going to use it to consume.
So that's that you're right, and that's just terrible. So why is it the top 1% of America has a bunch of bankers and advisors that are saying to them, here's how you can use debt strategically, and then the rest of 99% of America, we say, well, you're not responsible enough to handle any of these ideas, and so therefore we're just going to tell you one size fits all debt is bad, get rid of it as fast as you can, and mathematically we know you'll be stuck. It doesn't seem to make sense either.
I mean, the difficulty lies in the fact that it makes me think of the charts that you see where the vast majority of Americans have the vast majority of their wealth tied up in their primary residence. Mm-hmm. I guess the advantage there is that when folks know that they're paying that they're paying down their mortgage, and or in most cases just paying their mortgage, like it's a forced form of saving and investing their money in a sense. I guess I just can't get past that psychological side of the equation, because like mathematically, like I totally agree with you. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe this is where this message isn't necessarily for everyone out there, because if everybody did exactly with, you know, what you're saying here, like everybody would be smarter and richer. This is a message for folks who are either a little more disciplined or who can maybe be a little more rational in how it is that they approach money. But I think what we've seen is that the majority of folks aren't very rational when it comes to their money. Like they make knee-jerk reactions. They make purchases that they're not necessarily prepared for. They bring on debt into their life that wasn't necessarily designed or planned for. It was more of a, like, again, something that they fell into, and it's not something that they're able to continue servicing. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts or any advice for folks as to what approach maybe they should take, because on one hand, I totally hear what it is that you're saying here. But then on the other hand, just the statistics show that it seems that a lot of folks aren't actually able to take a more strategic approach when it comes to the debt that they have.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit to unpack there. So let's take it in,
in
sections. No, it's great. I think that the most important thing that we can accomplish in this interview is if somebody becomes more thoughtful that maybe some debt is good and some debt is bad, then that's a mission accomplished. And if they think, hey, I need to value liquidity, then that's part of the mission accomplished. Because it's hard to get into specifics for people, but then the next part of this is to exactly what you were saying. So let's say my mortgage is $2,500 a month and I have $3,000 and I'm thinking, well, I'm going to pay down more on my mortgage so that my mortgage is paid off earlier as I get closer to retirement. You can imagine somebody thinking something down that thought path, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to be a good steward of my money by paying more down on my mortgage so my mortgage is paid off earlier. That's a hypothesis that someone has, that's a good and responsible decision. Anyone who is able to make that type of a hypothesis or that type of a thought process should equally be able to do the math on what if they invested the $500 instead of paid it down right on their mortgage. And my simple thing that I would want people to do the analysis on is if you took that money and saved it and invested it responsibly over that same 30-year period of time, you'll have more money. You don't have to believe in much for that to be a better outcome for you.
All right. So I'm curious, kind of from a personal level too, Tom. My parents, they're like on the cusp of retirement, supposed to happen next month, which I'm excited for them about. And like they have still a mortgage that's at like 3%. I think they got about 6 years left on it. Mm-hmm. I have told them to keep that mortgage around because the added flexibility that it gives them.
Milk that 6 years.
Yeah, exactly. Like I know it may be in like the ideal of ideal worlds. You want more money in your retirement accounts and you want a bigger Social Security check. And whoa, wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have a mortgage either? But do you agree or disagree? Is it better to have the mortgage on hand and to prioritize keeping their assets, you know, growing for them and just kind of paying it off as agreed? Or how should retirees think about having paid off home?
Well, first of all, congratulations to them. They're in a great shape, and that's a neat conversation to be having. The best thing is if they've built up savings and they could choose to pay it off or they could choose to keep it, then you can kind of like ring a bell and say, you know, ding, 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 right? I won. Now we are having a fun conversation. Should I pay off my house or not? And that's a neat exercise. Look, at the tail end of the mortgage, if it's at 3%, the math answer is, sure, hopefully they should be able to earn a little bit more in other investments. And so keeping it would be the logic answer there. When the mortgage balance gets pretty small, though, if you do just pay it off, you have a huge cash flow savings where you no longer have to make that payment. And that, back to what you guys were talking about before from the psychological, is just awesome. So once the mortgage gets pretty small, then I kind of lean toward, you know, paying it off. At this point in time, I could vote either way on their kitchen table. I would just love the conversation. And as long as we talked about it, I'd feel great with the decision that they made. And I would love for everybody to have the same opportunity to have the same conversation that they would have when they are 60, 65, or 70 years old. What a neat thing to be able to do. Do I want to pay off my mortgage or not?
Yeah. Well, okay. So on that note, you've talked about the difference between somebody who's maybe looking at a 30-year fixed mortgage at a little bit higher rate as opposed to like a 5-year ARM where they might be able to get a killer rate, but the conventional wisdom goes, no, you don't want a rate that's going to end up, you know, blowing up in 5 years. You want to go with the sure thing. You want to get the higher rate, but to know that it's fixed. But you kind of point out how there are multiple things that we need to consider. And I mean, the likelihood of somebody actually staying in that home for 30 years, it's not super high.
It's almost non-existent. Yeah.
So yeah. Talk. I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts. Just talk a little bit about maybe being realistic with some of the timeframes that we are oftentimes facing
Yeah, so the first mortgage that I had was a 30-year fixed, and I feel like that should have been, that was financial malpractice. I don't know.
Right.
no one's in their first home for 30 years, and I was in mine for 3 or 4, which is relatively common, and the right product for me would have been, you know, a 5-year. And there's no chance that I was going to be in where it was for that long of a period. So you are absolutely right. When you're in a 30-year fixed loan, you're not locking in interest rates for 30 years. It's only if you're in that property, which is what's, as you both said, is very unusual. And so I agree completely. So I like things that are in the 5, 7, and 10 year range. I'm not opposed to interest only mortgages as long as you're saving the difference and you're not doing that for payment, which I hope people in California or anywhere close to water are listening to, because a lot of people use those to get more house, and that's not what you should be doing. Yeah. I don't like a 15-year fixed because I don't like the amortization and tying up the extra money in the home. I'd rather be building that up in a liquid portfolio. And I have been a pretty big advocate of the 30-year fixed when rates have been low. That has changed a little bit here recently, obviously. But for the past number of years, what a neat opportunity if you're a little bit later in life and there's a chance that you'll be in the home for a while to lock in the 30-year fixed. And I'm still not in any way opposed to it, because if you think you'll be in the home for a while, I think a 30-year fix could still be attractive.
Okay. Tom, this has been a great conversation. And I mean, hopefully it's at least whetted our listeners' appetite to learn a little bit more about what it looks like to use debt effectively. Where can they go to find out more about you and kind of the books you've written too?
Check me out on Amazon. You can find each of the 4 different books there. It's Value of Debt and Building Wealth, The Value of Debt and Retirement, and the original one is The Value of Debt. Another one out there on blockchain and the future of money, and would be honored for anyone to check them out.
Very cool. We'll make sure to link to those books. Tom, again, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we really appreciate you.
I appreciate you. It was a fun conversation. Thanks, guys.
All right, Matt, good conversation there with Tom Anderson about, and I'm sure some of our listeners saw the title of this episode and they were like, Matt Joel just go off the deep end? But no, we've been talking about the strategic use of debt for years, mm-hmm. and that might make us outliers in the personal finance community. I don't know. But again,
I think it'll be a conversation we continue to have.
Completely.
Right?
Yeah.
Because like you said, on one end of the spectrum are folks who are avoiding it like the plague. But then on the other, obviously the other end of the spectrum you want to completely avoid, right?
Yeah.
Folks who are taking on massive amounts of consumer debt, you don't want to do that. But this episode is
even
basically
at the end, by the way, he talked about buying that mortgage and he's like, if you're doing it just to be able to afford the property, no. Like,
exactly.
And if you're taking on debt just so that you can afford the thing that you otherwise wouldn't be able to, that's a no-no.
But same product, a mortgage, but a completely different heart, as to
different
where
way of
somebody
using it
might be. But yeah, this episode totally is for folks who are on that end of the spectrum of like, no, man, I'm paying down that mortgage because I'm getting after my finances.
I like to optimize.
Which I'll go ahead and get to my big takeaway. And we kind of got to it towards the end of the episode there because I was kind of torn because I'm trying to figure out how do you figure out.
I heard it in your speech.
Yeah, like how do you figure out if you are the kind of person who just wants to simplify and tackle it, you know, skin the cat that way, or if you're the type of person who can handle maybe some more complexity and optimizing it. And what he eventually said, I don't know his exact words, but what he was saying was that, like, if you are asking the question, can I use debt more strategically in my life? Just the very act of asking that question puts you in the camp of, oh, maybe you actually can handle it strategically because you are, by the fact that you're asking that question, you're thinking strategically, right? And so I think if you're listening to this and you're like, no, I can't do that. But if you are finding yourself drawn to some of the other ways that you might optimize your finances, optimize your money, well, I think that you possibly could be the type of person to think about your debt more strategically. You could be the person who might be more disciplined, where instead of paying down that debt, you're setting that money aside and you actually are actively investing that money as opposed to it burning a hole in your pocket and you getting sucked into just spending it.
Yeah.
So I think that can be just a good rule of thumb, a good takeaway for folks if you feel like you might be on the fence.
Well, he talked about the optimal debt ratio, which I think was good. Mm-hmm. I think my big takeaway too, though, was when he said you want to look at the holistic big picture. And so you're right. If you had the cash, the money to buy a home in cash, 5 years ago when mortgage rates were at 3% or I guess probably like 2.5 years ago, they were really good rates on mortgages, then still you would want to have taken out the mortgage because it's in your long-term best interest. And when you're looking at the big picture, now, boy, you feel super happy if you have a 3% mortgage rate. So look at the big picture and be careful about your debt ratio at the same time. I think there was a lot to kind of digest in this episode. And it's our goal to have folks of all different stripes on. You know, we had Jesse Meekham on recently, and you know, he's pretty debt averse. We've had Michelle Singletary, and she was like, I don't think there is such a thing as good debt. And then, you know, we want to interview Tom here, who says, no, there's ways to use debt to build wealth. And I think I fall somewhere in between, probably more along the lines of where Tom is. But I think it also needs to be said that it's different strokes for different folks. And there's folks like our friend Andy Hill, who paid off his mortgage even though it was super low interest rate because that was what was best for him mentally. And you kept referring back to that, Matt. I think that's just a really important part of the conversation. And we can talk numbers all day long, but if it doesn't work for us from a psychological, behavioral aspect.
Yeah, what are you actually going to do in real life? Because on paper, you could say that it'll work in this way. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but from a business, like as businesses are processing this, you have multiple people who are sitting down together and asking these questions of the business. You have a board of directors. You have, you know, like you've got the C-suite. You have all these individuals who are trying and testing and they're all working together. Whereas as individuals, man, it can be really easy just to be like, yeah, I'm not going to spend my money over there anymore. Like, I'm not going to invest that. Instead, I'm going to spend it over here.
It's easy, and it's easy to lie to yourself.
It's a slippery slope.
But if you're bouncing it off a crew of other people,
there isn't accountability when you are looking at yourself as an individual business, right? Like when you're thinking about yourself as the CEO of your own finances.
And there's a reason that our listeners, let's say they have student loans and the payment continues to be on pause, that most people aren't paying those student loans off right now, right? Because it's not necessarily debt that is the evil. It is the interest that goes along with it. And it's the interest that goes along with it if you can't find something better to do with that money. It's a difficult conundrum. Like there's not some sort of easy solution. Tom, I think, gave a lot of good kind of ways to think through it though.
Yep,
so hopefully people can make smart decisions in their lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's get back to the beer. You and I enjoyed this episode, a Hell's Lager. This is by New Park Brewing out of West Hartford, Connecticut. This one was donated to the show by Matthew. Matthew, we appreciate you as well as these beers that you sent us. But Joel, yeah, what were your thoughts on this tasty beverage?
Man, this one was clean, crisp, and delicious.
It was refreshing.
It really was.
Light, not light in like a Bud Light kind of way, but just in a, like you said, it had all of those lager-like flavors going on. But refreshing and not over heavy.
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the artwork. The artwork really reminded me of like my aunt, my great aunt. She used to do like this technique, this Scandinavian artistic technique called rose mulling. And it really, so this looks like Scandinavian art to me, this beer can picture.
Is that like sewing? Like I thought you were
like painting. Cross-stitching. It's like painting, but it's like kind of got, it's like geometric flower kind of stuff going on. So maybe not geometric. Maybe that's, but it looks like this. We'll post. And by the way, if you're curious what the can looks like, you can follow us on Instagram at How to Money Pod, and Matt posts all the pictures of the beers we drink there.
Well, I do my best to, at the very least. You can find our show notes up on the website as well at howtomoney.com, and we'll make sure to link to Tom's books as well, so you can look into that.
For sure. And we have done a couple of episodes, Matt, where you and I, we just talked about debt and how to pursue like a strategic debt plan in your life where you're not overdoing it, but where you're not also buying into that debt is dumb philosophy. Mm-hmm. We'll link to those in the show notes too, so people can go back and hear maybe our unabridged thoughts on it too. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you find yourself wrestling with the idea of,
and you want more,
from a principled standpoint, I want to get rid of this in my life, but I guess truly what the question is at this point is, can I handle that additional complexity? Will I do the right thing if I do keep this debt around?
For sure. Yeah. So that's going to do it for this episode though. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.
A lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.